Well, that's Onward, Christian Soldiers, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show where we like to discuss important current events for conservatives and others. And today we're in a church militant mood of mind, listening to the classic there of Onward, Christian Soldiers, for we want to discuss a new great book out by our friend Austin Ruse entitled Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic, which just came out this week on April 27th. And in this book, Austin Ruse discusses ongoing culture war that has come into full bloom in the United States and in the modern West, and how Catholics and other Orthodox Christians, other religious believers, are facing a modern challenge, a great struggle that people will look back on in the future as being another time of contention, like, say, the Cold War. Well, join us today to discuss his latest book. It's Austin Ruse. Welcome to the show, Austin.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be with you. I just want to let your listeners know that the book came out this week, but it has been number one in new releases, new Catholic releases at Amazon for more than a week. So it's doing very, very well.
All right. Excellent. Well, that's all the more reason for our listeners out there to get a copy of this book out from Crisis Publications. Again, the title is Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic. Well, looking at this book, Austin, you know, it's really an interesting analysis. You write in here that, for example, we warm ourselves with the cold comfort of believing that at least we seem better to be than the ancient Romans in your book. But as you analyze in the book, other writers like the British writer Ferdinand Mount, he wrote a book called Full Circle, How the Classical World Came Back to Us, that we're actually kind of living in a neo-pagan time. Discuss that for our listeners.
Well, you know, the book that informed me the most about this is a book called Pagans and Christians in the City, The Culture Wars from the Tiber to the Potomac, written by a law professor at the University of San Diego by the name of Stephen Smith, who's an expert on the First Amendment, free speech, the Establishment Clause. And what he had shown me was that the debates that we're having now in the United States are pretty much the same that they had at the time of the rise of Christianity in the first, second, and third centuries, and the back and forth between those who kept the old gods and those who accepted the Christian God, the God of the universe. And the debate centered then and now around what do we do in public spaces? Who gets spaces with their faith? And this went back and forth in the Roman days. You know, there were pagan symbols that were changed into Christian symbols and then changed back. There was government money that went to support first pagan enterprises and then Christian enterprises. So that was one debate that went on at that time and is obviously going on now. Additionally, the big debate at that time was about how the new morality of the Christians, that is to say, one wife for life, you know, no sex outside of marriage and all that kind of stuff. And Rome was awash in perverse sexuality. So there was that conflict between the Romans who had the old gods and the Christians. And you can see that playing out in exactly the same way today. The only difference is the pagans, it's hard to label them. I call them immanentists. The immanentists are on the rise now, and the Christians are on the back foot.
Yeah, you discussed that in the book that, from this Ferdinand Mount, in his book, Full Circle, he noted that technically the word pagan means rural, because Christians would refer to these rural people as being backward people because they kept these old pagan gods. But as you indicate here, he had the term immanentists that is, say, people who do not see beyond the material world, and they think this material world, in particular, like sex, is really sacred. So that's their primary focus, you know, getting your joys out of the world today. Well, it brings up issues. Go ahead.
It's where you see the sacred. And the immanentists place the sacred in the world that they can see on this temporal plane. And those who have a transcendent view understand that our sacred is, you know, beyond this world. Even though we can see the work of God in this world, we don't place God in the trees. We don't place God in sex. Which is what the new eminentists absolutely do. Watching a half a dozen episodes, for instance, of Gwyneth Paltrow's television series on Netflix will show you how deeply religious, but in an eminent way, a lot of these people are. You know, she did one whole episode about energy that's supposed to course outside a person's body up to 2 or 3 feet, and you can feel it, and you can give them, and they believe that we come from energy, that we return to energy, and all that kind of stuff. So I also argue in the book, as you know, that we do not live in a secular age. We live in a deeply religious age, and that's what Christians are up against, is these new eminentists.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You mentioned, of course, the great awakening, this new woke faith, and I like this phrase here that you say that the fight between the pagans and the Christians was finally over. It was thought in the 4th century, but it's not. It will never be until the second coming. Now these pagans are back with a vengeance. It reminds me of your talk about what do we put in public. Of course, you go back to Catholic priest Father Richard John Newhouse. He had, of course, his column in First Things, the public square, right? I mean, this was a theme that he brought up of what he talked about, the naked public square and what you put in the public square. So you're really calling back to that.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Because we fight these days about, you know, whether there's going to be, you know, a cross on public land or a manger scene on public land, and whether there should be funding for religious education and all that kind of stuff. These are exactly the same debates that happened in Rome at the time of early Christianity. It is quite remarkable. And the book from this guy Mount is utterly fascinating, because he says that we have returned explicitly to a pagan world, and he praises it. There's another book that I quote in there by a former, I think he was the dean of the NYU Law School, a man named Kroneman, who wrote an entire big fat book called Confessions of a Pagan. So there is an explicit return to pagan practices and people who literally call themselves pagan, but most people don't. You know, they are participants in, you know, what we would consider to be New Age or the sex obsessed or a whole bunch of other, you know, or pantheists. You know, even one of the remarkable things I found in my research, and this was pointed out to me by Chad Pecknold, who's a professor at Catholic University, even de Tocqueville, way back then, said that the choice eventually in America will have to be between Americans will have to choose between paganism and Catholicism. Paganism and Catholicism. De Tocqueville recognized that, and that's kind of what we're going through right now. It is quite remarkable.
Yeah, now that was an interesting point, and I've heard that. I've come across that Tocqueville quote before. This French writer, Alexis de Tocqueville, visiting America in the 1830s and wrote the famous work, Democracy in America. And one of the observations he made coming from a Catholic French background is that he thought that Americans would someday indeed have to choose between pantheism, precisely a lot of this New Age stuff that we have now, or the Catholic Church on the other hand. Analyzing the Catholic Church and, say, in a majority Protestant country, the United States, and Protestant denominations, what sort of advantages or differences are there with the Catholic Church taking on this neo-pagan agenda, all of these sexual agendas, as opposed to other Protestant churches in the United States?
Well, you know, the Protestants gave in now decades and decades ago to the very beginnings of the sexual revolution, you know, at the Lambeth Conference. What was that, in the 20s or 30s? Where they stepped away from a condemnation of contraception. Their theology and ecclesiology is just not strong enough to stand up to the winds of change. And I would just point out that the Catholic Church has never changed even a bit in her teaching on contraception, on marriage, on family, on abortion, you know, the dignity of the human person. I mean, on and on and on. Even though the gale force winds in the culture demand that the church change. The church never has. So I think that Tocqueville saw something in the Catholic Church which was a little bit sturdier than what he saw in the Protestant denominations at the time, and certainly going forward, abundantly so.
Yeah, of course, yeah, the Lambeth Conference from 1931 in the Anglican Communion, often seen as a key date where the first break in the stand of Christians against contraception occurred, and then other churches followed in that step, and then that fundamental redefinition of sex, that it's no longer defined according to these purposes of marital unity and procreation, but rather it can be reduced to a sort of purely pleasurable act, and that had a revolutionary consequence, as Pope Paul VI noted in Humanae Vitae in 1968, the encyclical of how that revolutionizes the understanding of sex. Well, looking at and of course, also you make the interesting point in your book that the Southern Baptist Convention, on the day that the Roe v. Wade decision was handed down, January 22nd, 1973, you know, they approved of it. And of course, now, you know, Southern Baptists have gone back on that. So it raises a lot of question about what sort of moral authority such groups have.
Well, you know, that is in the section of the book where I talk about the great good news. You know, God can bring good out of any evil, and what possible good can he bring out of the attacks on life and family and marriage? And one of them is the great coming together of his Christian children. You know, it's like evangelicals and Catholics have largely put aside their differences over theology and ecclesiology in order to fight new state religion that we see. And you point back to the early days of the abortion debate. And yeah, on the day that Roe v. Wade was handed down, the Southern Baptist Convention praised the decision. I mean, it's quite remarkable how far they've come. And now we look at various parts of the Southern Baptist Convention and we see them getting weak on LGBT issues and things like that. I mean, and it's not a surprise. There is a rock out there, and it is Peter. And I also point out in the book that the fact that we have a rock, a magisterium, is very attractive to the people that we make common cause with, because people are attracted to a strong truth. You know, one of the great goods when I talk about the great coming together of his children is that we put aside all these differences to work on this common foe, but in the process, friendship grows, love grows, familiarity grows, and this is a great, you know, the pro-life cause is a great funnel of conversions from the evangelical churches to the Catholic Church.
Yeah, well, I know from personal experience, of course, one of my professors at Amherst College was Hadley Arkes, who was a Orthodox Jew and,
yep,
great scholar of natural law and deeply involved in the pro-life movement, really a pro-life legal pioneer. And then, of course, over time through that involvement, he came into the Catholic Church. So that's one example I know of from precisely a Jewish background. So yeah, that entree of the natural moral law does often lead people then,
yeah,
to come into closer contact with the theological teachings of the Catholic Church.
You know, one of the great stories that Frank Beckwith tells, you know, Frank Beckwith is one of these converted. He was the head of the Evangelical Theological Association, converted to the Catholic Church now many years ago. In his conversion story, he talks about he was at Princeton in one of these summer programs that Robbie George puts on. And late at night in his room, he gets a phone call from Hadley Arkes, who at the time was still Jewish. And he said, "What is keeping you out of the Catholic Church?" And so Hadley called late at night to put the arm on Frank Beckwith to convert to the Catholic Church. It was quite remarkable. And then Hadley, of course, many years later converted. When I read that column, when I read that book and saw that and read that anecdote, I actually wrote a column for the Catholic Thing. And the headline was "Hadley, It's Time." And it was before he had converted, you know, finally. And it was a column about, "Hey, you said this to Frank Beckwith. I think it's time for you to." And it never ran because Bob Royal showed it to Hadley, and Hadley really didn't like it. But sure enough, he eventually converted. And, you know, it's like Frank and Scott Hahn. And one of the things I don't write about it, this in the book, but one of the things that I believe is that we are getting their most best catechized, and they are getting our worst. You know, so we get the Scott Hahns, and they get the folks that have never really catechized themselves into the Catholic Church and go off in search of Jesus. And hopefully they find him in the evangelical denominations and then eventually come back to the Catholic Church. But as I say in the book, it's a remarkable time to be a faithful Catholic.
Well, you know, speaking about fighting back, you know, I guess looking at the kind of things you've written here in this book, and you've had writings about this before, sort of your interaction and with others, with David French, you know, he's coming from then an evangelical background. I guess he's in the Southern Baptist Convention. How would you compare and contrast sort of your advocacy, your positions on taking on these fights, and saying what David French has done?
Well, you know, David French has been a genuine fighter on the life issues in the legal sphere for many, many years. He got thrown off track during the run-up to the Trump election in 2016. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, that he was anti-Trump early on, and he came under pressure from Trump folks, and he got trolled on Twitter and things like that. And that spun him off in a whole other direction. I mean, I have no doubt that he's 100% pro-life, but he, like a lot of these guys, has changed in some fundamental way that I don't truly understand. I think it's essentially political that has washed over into what they consider to be the proper application of faith and in politics. Pete Wehner is another one at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Michael Gerson, who I at this point have not read in months and months and months, at the Washington Post, speechwriter, evangelical speechwriter for George Bush, is another one. And they've developed a real hostility to conservatism in the Christian churches. And like I said, I don't truly understand it.
That's interesting. I guess we'll have to write that down to another Trump derangement syndrome effect. More about fighting, you know, it's interesting you write in here, I guess, looking at the media and our wider culture, you talk about how, you know, the media has been swamped with all these LGBT agendas, like the New York Times in 1995 only had a grand total of 2 mentions of the word transgender, but in 2016 it was like 1,166 times, or more than an average of 3 stories per day. Also, you talked about, I tried to write a column once for the New York Post about a law in the New York City Council that would have banned any sort of talk therapy for anyone with unwanted same-sex desires. And the New York Post insisted that you say that this should be banned, and so the article never ran. How should people look at the media today on these issues? Can we even speak of any objective media anymore? Is this just outright propaganda, a new sexual Pravda?
Well, you know, just a slight correction on the New York Post column. They were fine with me condemning the law that would ban talk therapy, but they believed that it ought to be banned for minors. And I wasn't willing to do that because even minors have a right to talk therapy for the things that bother them. And so the column never ran because I wasn't willing to say that. I mean, because I don't believe it. I couldn't write something I didn't believe. But, yeah, you know, after Obergefell, you know, the media everywhere has pretty much determined that certain topics are now completely off limits. There is some wiggle room right now on the transgender issue, but on the same-sex issue, It is, and we were warned about this by Maggie Gallagher and others. It is tantamount to racism and it, you know, homophobia and hatred and all that kind of stuff. So I suspect that at some point it will also become off limits to take an opposing view on the transgender question. But you know, there's still people out there slugging away. You know, Ryan is still out there. I'm still out there. You know, but people are afraid to step forward. You know, I argue in the book that we now live under a new established church, and this church has the full force of the federal government and the state governments and certainly corporations backing it, and they will step out and they will punish the heretics, and this is abundantly clear to everyone. You know, I argue in the book that this nascent new established church really began, and I learned this from Stephen Smith at the University of San Diego Law School in 1962, when in the school prayer decision, when the Supreme Court said the object and purpose of government must be secular, that is to say, without God. Prior to that, there was a fairly healthy debate between, you could say, even that they were considered political parties, those that Stephen Smith called providentialists on one side, who believe that the hand of God is in history and we can see it and this has to be communicated in the public square, even in schools, and those who are secularists who say that all of that kind of stuff is off limits in the public square and certainly in schools. Well, in 1962, the Supreme Court determined that the federal government would enter into that debate on one side, the secular side, and then begin to impose it. And what did we see following that? We saw the contraception decisions, Griswold and Eisenstadt, followed by Roe v. Wade in 73, followed by, in the 90s and aughts, decisions on sodomy, constitutionalizing sodomy. And following that, of course, the same-sex marriage decision 2015. So, and all of that is then imposed, like I say, from the federal government, the Department of Justice, the Department of Education, all the way down to the local school a mile from where I sit, where children are taught a religious dogma that sex is assigned at birth, a religious dogma that boys can turn into girls. None of this is based in science. It is all based in faith of this new religion, which I sometimes call the new eminentists.
Yeah, in particular, you know, I remember Todd Starnes talking about 6 months ago, a couple of months ago, about Fox News, that apparently their new policy they've adopted in recent decades is they want to not criticize homosexual activists. And you think of leading figures like not only Anderson Cooper at CNN, who famously, you know, publicly, he and his gay partner, they had this, you know, this birth of a child from some surrogate mother and adopted that,
yeah.
And, you know, Shepard Smith,
yeah,
at Fox News. And so, you know, it seems to, and just recently I was watching on Fox News, they were discussing Caitlyn Jenner's proposal to run for governor in California. And one of the anchors was saying that it was talking about misgendering of Caitlyn Jenner. You know, you can't call this,
yeah,
guy a guy anymore. We all have to go along with the idea that this is a woman. So
yeah,
yeah, it, even if it's even at Fox News, there's no alternative source there.
It is a new faith. It is absolutely a new faith, and it is being imposed by the federal government on Christian children. And this is something that Christians have to come to understand, is that they are forcing a new dogma on our children in public schools. And this was why the school prayer decision was so important. For them is because it took, I mean, the school prayer that they struck down was, Almighty God, please send your blessings upon our country, our leaders, our teachers, and our parents. That was it. And it was written by a committee of Catholics, Protestants, Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish clergy, and it had wide support. When it was upheld by 13 judges before it got to the Supreme Court and struck down. When it was struck down, there were editorials condemning the decision from coast to coast, from border to border. That every single governor in the United States condemned it, with the exception of the New York State governor. There was not a widespread call to strike down prayer in public schools. This was culture following politics. You know how Andrew Breitbart said politics follows culture, is downstream from culture. In this case, culture followed, was downstream from politics, because it was a political decision that was imposed upon the country, in the same way that contraception was imposed, in the same way that abortion was imposed. All of this was politics upstream from culture, because the culture followed these political decisions. And all of this is rooted in this new faith.
Yeah, I mean, that brings back, I guess, conservatives among have noted the idea that, you know, law is a teacher, and so, you know, law can indeed impart lessons to the culture, or at least what the law thinks the culture should be. You know, does that raise the question,
right,
coming back to Hadley Arkes, do we have to then reconsider in our society and culture the role of the judiciary, the courts? Jennifer Roback Morris, in her similar book, The Sexual State, notes how this entire sort of sexual state policies on contraception and sodomy and marriage and so forth came from the courts. Do we have to emphasize more, like Hadley argues, that the judiciary does not have the last word on these issues? I mean, we can criticize these decisions and say, okay, we respect the power of, say, the Supreme Court, but we don't agree with that, and take sort of a Abraham Lincoln position that, you know, in our own powers in the legislative and the executive, and we the people are going to manifest an opposing view.
You know, Matthew Frank, who is at Princeton and connected to the James Madison program, gave a really important speech that was turned into an essay now, you know, 7 or 8 years ago on this precise point. And he says, yes, that, you know, what one way to hamper the court, because the court is out of control. You know, I was sitting with Justice Scalia at a prayer breakfast now 15, 20 years ago, and somebody walked up to him and gave him a petition on some issue. And he turned to me and he said, in a better world, they wouldn't know my name. Let alone walk up with a petition. But Matt Frank said that there are solutions that can be offered to hamper the court, and one of them is to expand their jurisdiction and make them decide on hundreds of other different kinds of cases, so that they're so busy that they won't spend all of their time in legislating from the bench. And yes, to have certain parts of the federal government stand up to the Supreme Court and say, you know, we take the oath too, and we determine that this is the way to interpret the Constitution and not your way. And you know, this challenges an early decision of the court that says that the court decided for itself that they had the unique position of determining how to interpret the Constitution. But all branches of the federal government have a role in interpreting the Constitution. So I don't see a way out of this unless, you know, more and more people, more and more institutions of the federal government are willing to stand up to the court. I don't see that happening, however.
Well, I guess in closing out, you know, we've mentioned the schools here. In your experience in the book, you talk about your experience in Fairfax County, Northern Virginia, the school board there in suburban Washington, D.C. And all, you know, as you mentioned before, all these agendas on explicit sex education and sexualizing of children and all of this gender identity is being pushed on to kids. And yet, you know, the schools are supposed to inculcate a national identity. They're teaching not just reading, writing, and arithmetic, but indeed national values. I mean, what public interest do these LGBT agendas serve in the schools, and are lawmakers or members of the public standing up and fighting it back against what is indeed a private capture of public institutions?
Well, you know, how we view ourselves as a people is expressed in how we teach our children. And this was one of the key points about the school prayer decision, was that it said that we may no longer in the schools express the providentialist nature of who we are as a people, and therefore it was taken over by the people without God. So yes, it is a crucial battleground. You know, when I travel around and I give talks about my work at the UN, which is my day job, people say, what can I do? And I said, you know, we don't really need you at the UN. We need you to take over the local school board. The school boards coast to coast have been taken over by the radicals. And so this has to be changed. You know, regular folks have to get involved and run for school board, take over the school board, take the schools back from the radicals. That's the only way that this will change. But unfortunately, a lot of these radical ideas, they may have started in the public schools, but they're being ratified by state governments. For instance, here in Virginia, the state legislature has now sort of endorsed all the craziness that's going on in the grade schools and have made it a directive that all schools in the state have to adhere to the LGBT agenda. So that, you know, there are states that are conservative that need to act. You know, and one of the things that we're seeing, and I think it's a good thing, is these legislative ideas to protect girls' sports. Sadly, we see some governors, Asa Hutchinson and what's her name from South Dakota, vetoing these types of bills, which is tragic, But this is the kind of thing that has to happen, is in the state legislatures and all the way down to the school board, that conservatives have to get involved. Having reading groups is not enough. The Benedict option is not enough. You have to get involved in the local school board and state legislative battles. That's the only way.
Well, I would recommend to all of our listeners here for reading to pick up on these battles and have a battle plan going out to get a copy of Austin Ruse's new book, Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic. It's an excellent book. I highly recommend it. And Austin Ruse, thank you for joining us here today on Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show where we analyze issues, important issues of the day for conservatives and others. For our listeners out there, join us next Friday for another episode with your show host, Andrew Harris, Conservative Casual Friday. Thank you very much, Austin Ruse.
Thanks for having me.